Welcome to The Great Stories. I'm Trev Downey, and each week I'll read and then discuss a truly great short story by one of the iconic authors. Who doesn't enjoy being told a tale? Humans have been telling each other yarns as long as language itself has existed. Stories to entertain, to inspire, to frighten, and to teach. On this podcast, there will be no academic elitism. We will focus only on the story you'll be told, the context in which it appeared, and the author responsible for its creation. The Great Stories, you see, is for everyone. So, gather round, and let's enjoy this episode's tale. Young Goodman Brown by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Young Goodman Brown came forth at sunset into the street of Salem Village, but put his head back after crossing the threshold to exchange a parting kiss with his young wife, and Faith, as the wife was aptly named, thrust her own pretty head into the street, letting the wind play with the pink ribbons of her cap while she called to Goodman Brown. "Dearest heart," whispered she softly and rather sadly, when her lips were close to his ear, "prithee put off your journey until sunrise, and sleep in your own bed tonight. A lone woman is troubled with such dreams and such thoughts that she's afeard of herself sometimes. Pray, tarry with me this night, dear husband, of all nights in the year." "My love and my faith," replied young Goodman Brown, "of all nights in the year, this one night must I tarry away from thee. My journey, as thou callest it, forth and back again, must needs be done twixt now and sunrise. What, my sweet pretty wife, dost thou doubt me already, and we but 3 months married?" "Then God bless you," said Faith with the pink ribbons, "and may you find all well when you come back." "Amen," cried Goodman Brown. "Say thy prayers, dear Faith, and go to bed at dusk, and no harm will come to thee." So they parted, and the young man pursued his way until, being about to turn the corner by the meeting-house, he looked back and saw the head of Faith still peeping after him with a melancholy air, in spite of her pink ribbons. "Poor little Faith," thought he, for his heart smote him. "What a wretch am I, to leave her on such an errand. She talks of dreams, too. Methought as she spoke there was trouble in her face, as if a dream had warned her what work is to be done tonight. But no. No, 'twould kill her to think it. Well, she's a blessed angel on earth, and after this one night I'll cling to her skirts and follow her to heaven." With this excellent resolve for the future, Goodman Brown felt himself justified in making more haste on his present evil purpose. He had taken a dreary road, darkened by all the gloomiest trees of the forest, which barely stood aside to let the narrow path creep through, and closed immediately behind. It was all as lonely as could be, and there is this peculiarity in such a solitude that the traveller knows not who may be concealed by the innumerable trunks and the thick boughs overhead, so that, with lonely footsteps, he may yet be passing through an unseen multitude. "There may be a devilish Indian behind every tree," said Goodman Brown to himself, and he glanced fearfully behind him, as he added, "What if the devil himself should be at my very elbow?" His head being turned back, he passed a crook of the road, and looking forward again, beheld the figure of a man, in grave and decent attire, seated at the foot of an old tree. He arose at Goodman Brown's approach, and walked onward, side by side with him. "You are late, Goodman Brown," said he. "The clock of the Old South was striking as I came through Boston, and that is full 15 minutes agone." "Faith kept me back a while," replied the young man, with a tremor in his voice caused by the sudden appearance of his companion, though not wholly unexpected. It was now deep dusk in the forest, and deepest in that part of it where the two were journeying. As nearly as could be discerned, the second traveller was about 50 years old, apparently in the same rank of life as Goodman Brown, and bearing a considerable resemblance to him, though perhaps more in expression than features. Still, they might have been taken for a father and son. And yet, though the elder person was as simply clad as the younger, and as simple in manner too, he had an indescribable air of one who knew the world, and would not have felt abashed at the governor's dinner table, or in King William's court, were it possible that his affairs should call him thither. But the only thing about him that could be fixed upon as remarkable was his staff, which bore the likeness of a great black snake, so curiously wrought that it might almost be seen to twist and wriggle itself like a living serpent. This, of course, must have been an ocular deception assisted by the uncertain light. "Come, Goodman Brown," cried his fellow traveller, "this is a dull place for beginning a journey. Take my staff if you are so soon weary." "Friend," said the other, exchanging his slow pace for a full stop, "having kept covenant by meeting thee here, it is my purpose now to return whence I came. I have scruples touching the matter thou wottest of."
"Sayest thou so?" replied he of the serpent, smiling apart. "Let us walk on, nevertheless, reasoning as we go, and if I convince thee not, thou shalt turn back. We are but a little way in the forest yet."
"Too far, too far," exclaimed the goodman, unconsciously resuming his walk. "My father never went into these woods on such an errand, nor his father before him. We have been a race of honest men and good Christians since the days of the martyrs. And shall I be the first of the name of Brown that ever took this path and kept
such company, thou wouldst say?"
observed the elder person, interrupting his pause.
"Well said, Goodman Brown. I have been as well acquainted with your family as ever a one among the Puritans, and that's no trifle to say. I helped your grandfather, the constable, when he lashed the Quaker woman so smartly through the streets of Salem, and it was I that brought your father a pitch-pine knot kindled at my own hearth to set fire to an Indian village in King Philip's War. They were my good friends, both, and many a pleasant walk have we had along this path and returned merrily after midnight. I would fain be friends with you, for their sake."
"If it be as thou sayest," replied Goodman Brown, "I marvel they never spoke of these matters, or verily I marvel not, seeing that the least rumour of the sort would have driven them from New England. We are a people of prayer, and good works to boot, and abide no such wickedness."
"Wickedness or not," said the traveller with the twisted staff, "I have a very general acquaintance here in New England. The deacons of many a church have drunk the communion wine with me. The selectmen of divers towns make me their chairman, and a majority of the great and general court are firm supporters of my interest. The governor and I too, but these are state secrets."
"Can this be so?" cried Goodman Brown, with a stare of amazement at his undisturbed companion. "Howbeit, I have nothing to do with the governor and council. They have their own ways, and are no rule for a simple husbandman like me. But were I to go on with thee, how should I meet the eye of that good old man, our minister at Salem Village? Oh, his voice would make me tremble, both Sabbath day and lecture day."
Thus far the elder traveller had listened with due gravity, but now burst into a fit of irrepressible mirth, shaking himself so violently that his snake-like staff actually seemed to wriggle in sympathy.
"Ha ha ha!" shouted he again and again.
Then, composing himself, "Well, go on, Goodman Brown, go on, but prithee, don't kill me with laughing."
"Well then, to end the matter at once," said Goodman Brown, considerably nettled, "there is my wife, Faith. It would break her dear little heart, and I'd rather break my own."
"Nay, if that be the case," answered the other, "e'en go thy ways, Goodman Brown. I would not, for 20 old women like the one hobbling before us, that Faith should come to any harm."
As he spoke, he pointed his staff at a female figure on the path, in whom Goodman Brown recognized a very pious and exemplary dame, who had taught him his catechism in youth and was still his moral and spiritual adviser, jointly with the minister and Deacon Gookin.
"A marvel, truly, that Goody Cloyes should be so far in the wilderness at nightfall," said he.
"But with your leave, friend, I shall take a cut through the woods until we have left this Christian woman behind. Being a stranger to you, she might ask whom I was consorting with and whither I was going."
"Be it so," said his fellow traveller. "Betake you to the woods, and let me keep the path."
Accordingly, the young man turned aside, but took care to watch his companion, who advanced softly along the road until he had come within a staff's length of the old dame. She, meanwhile, was making the best of her way, with a singular speed for so aged a woman, and mumbling some indistinct words, a prayer, doubtless, as she went. The traveller put forth his staff and touched her withered neck with what seemed the serpent's tail.
"The devil!" screamed the pious old lady. "Then Goody Cloyes knows her old friend," observed the traveller, confronting her and leaning on his writhing stick.
"Ah, forsooth, is it your worship, indeed?" cried the good dame,
Yea, truly is it, and in the very image of my old gossip Goodman Brown, the grandfather of the silly fellow that now is. But would your worship believe it, my broomstick hath strangely disappeared, stolen, as I suspect, by that unhanged witch Goody Corey, and that, too, when I was all anointed with the juice of smallage and cinquefoil and wolfsbane, mixed with fine wheat and the fat of a newborn babe, said the shape of old Goodman Brown. Ha! Your worship knows the recipe, cried the old lady, cackling aloud. So as I was saying, being all ready for the meeting and no horse to ride on, I made up my mind to foot it, for they tell me there is a nice young man to be taken into communion tonight. But now your good worship will lend me your arm, and we shall be there in a twinkling. Well, that can hardly be, answered her friend. I may not spare you my arm, Goody Cloyes, but here is my staff, if you will. So saying, he threw it down at her feet, where, perhaps, it assumed life, being one of the rods which its owner had formerly lent to Egyptian magi. Of this fact, however, Goodman Brown could not take cognizance. He had cast up his eyes in astonishment, and looking down again, beheld neither Goody Cloyes nor the serpentine staff, but his fellow traveller alone, who waited for him as calmly as if nothing had happened. "That old woman taught me catechism," said the young man, and there was a world of meaning in this simple comment. They continued to walk onward, while the elder traveller exhorted his companion to make good speed and persevere in the path, discoursing so aptly that his argument seemed rather to spring up in the bosom of his auditor than to be suggested by himself. As they went, he plucked a branch of maple to serve for a walking stick and began to strip it of the twigs and little boughs which were wet with evening dew. The moment his fingers touched them, they became strangely withered and dried up, as with a week's sunshine. Thus the pair proceeded at a good free pace, until suddenly in a gloomy hollow of the road, Goodman Brown sat himself down on the stump of a tree and refused to go any farther. "Friend," said he stubbornly, "my mind is made up. Not another step will I budge on this errand. What if a wretched old woman do choose to go to the devil when I thought she was going to heaven? Is that any reason why I should quit my dear faith and go after her?" "You will think better of this by and by," said his acquaintance composedly. "Sit here and rest yourself a while, and when you feel like moving again, there is my staff to help you along." Without more words, he threw his companion the maple stick, and was as speedily out of sight as if he had vanished into the deepening gloom. The young man sat a few moments by the roadside, applauding himself greatly and thinking with how clear a conscience he should meet the minister in his morning walk, nor shrink from the eye of good old Deacon Gookin. And what calm sleep would be his that very night, which was to have been spent so wickedly, but purely and sweetly now, in the arms of faith. Amidst these pleasant and praiseworthy meditations, Goodman Brown heard the tramp of horses along the road, and deemed it advisable to conceal himself within the verge of the forest, conscious of the guilty purpose that had brought him thither, though now so happily turned from it. On came the hoof tramps, and the voices of the riders, two grave old voices, conversing soberly as they drew near. These mingled sounds appeared to pass along the road within a few yards of the young man's hiding place, but owing, doubtless, to the depth of gloom at that particular spot, neither the travellers nor their steeds were visible. Though their figures brushed the small boughs by the wayside, it could not be seen that they intercepted, even for a moment, the faint gleam from the strip of bright sky athwart which they must have passed. Goodman Brown alternately crouched and stood on tiptoe, pulling aside the branches and thrusting forth his head as far as he durst, without discerning so much as a shadow. It vexed him the more because he could have sworn, were such a thing possible, that he recognised the voices of the minister and Deacon Gookin, jogging along quietly as they were wont to do, when bound to some ordination or ecclesiastical council. While yet within hearing, one of the riders stopped to pluck a switch. "Of the two, reverend sir," said the voice like the deacon's, "I had rather miss an ordination dinner than tonight's meeting. They tell me that some of our community are to be here from Falmouth and beyond, and others from Connecticut and Rhode Island, besides several of the Indian powwows who, after their fashion, know almost as much deviltry as the best of us. Moreover, there is a goodly young woman to be taken into communion." "Mighty well, Deacon Gookin," replied the solemn old tones of the minister. "Spur up, or we shall be late. Nothing can be done, you know, until I get on the ground." The hoofs clattered again, and the voices, talking so strangely in the empty air, passed on through the forest, where no church had ever been gathered, nor solitary Christian prayed. Whither, then, could these holy men be journeying so deep into the heathen wilderness? Young Goodman Brown caught hold of a tree for support, being ready to sink down on the ground, faint and overburdened with a heavy sickness of his heart. He looked up to the sky, doubting whether there really was a heaven above him. Yet there was the blue arch and the stars brightening it. "With heaven above and faith below, I will yet stand firm against the devil," cried Goodman Brown. While he still gazed upward into the deep arch of the firmament and had lifted his hands to pray, a cloud, though no wind was stirring, hurried across the zenith and hid the brightening stars. The blue sky was still visible, except directly overhead, where this black mass of cloud was sweeping swiftly northward. Aloft in the air, as if from the depths of the cloud, came a confused and doubtful sound of voices. Once, the listener fancied that he could distinguish the accent of townspeople of his own. Men and women, both pious and ungodly, many of whom he had met at the communion table and had seen others rioting at the tavern. The next moment, so indistinct were the sounds, he doubted whether he had heard aught but the murmur of the old forest, whispering without a wind. Then came a stronger swell of those familiar tones, heard daily in the sunshine at Salem Village, but never, until now, from a cloud of night. There was one voice of a young woman, uttering lamentations, yet with an uncertain sorrow, and entreating for some favour which, perhaps, it would grieve her to obtain. And all the unseen multitude, both saints and sinners, seemed to encourage her onward. "Faith!" cried Goodman Brown in a voice of agony and desperation, and the echoes of the forest mocked him, crying, "Faith! Faith!" as if bewildered wretches were seeking her all through the wilderness. The cry of grief, rage, and terror was yet piercing the night when the unhappy husband held his breath for a response. There was a scream, drowned immediately in a louder murmur of voices, fading into far-off laughter as the dark cloud swept away, leaving a clear and silent sky above Goodman Brown. But something fluttered lightly down through the air and caught on the branch of a tree. The young man seized it and beheld a pink ribbon. "My faith is gone," cried he, after one stupefied moment. "There is no good on earth, and sin is but a name. Come, devil, for to thee is the world given." And, maddened with despair, so that he laughed loud and long, did Goodman Brown grasp his staff and set forth again at such a rate that he seemed to fly along the forest path rather than to walk or run. The road grew wilder and drearier and more faintly traced, and vanished at length, leaving him in the heart of dark wilderness, still rushing onward with the instinct that guides mortal men to evil. The whole forest was peopled with frightful sound, the creaking of the trees, the howling of wild beasts, and the yell of Indians, while sometimes the wind tolled like a distant church bell, and sometimes gave a broad roar around the traveller, as if all nature were laughing him to scorn. But he was himself the chief horror of the scene, and shrank not from its other horrors. "Ha, ha, ha!" roared Goodman Brown, when the wind laughed at him. "Let us hear which will laugh loudest. Think not to frighten me with your deviltry. Come witch, come wizard, come Indian powwow, come devil himself, and here comes Goodman Brown. You may as well fear him as he fear you." In truth, all through the haunted forest, there could be nothing more frightful than the figure of Goodman Brown. On he flew among the black pines, brandishing his staff with frenzied gestures, now giving vent to an inspiration of horrid blasphemy, and now shouting forth such laughter as set all the echoes of the forest laughing like demons around him. The fiend in his own shape is less hideous than when he rages in the breast of man. Thus sped the demoniac on his course, until quivering among the trees he saw a red light before him, as when the felled trunks and branches of a clearing have been set on fire, and throw up their lurid blaze against the sky at the hour of midnight. He paused in a lull of the tempest that had driven him onward, and heard the swell of what seemed a hymn rolling solemnly from a distance, with the weight of many voices. He knew the tune. It was a familiar one in the choir of the village meeting house. The verse died heavily away, and was lengthened by a chorus, not of human voices, but of all the sounds of the benighted wilderness, pealing in awful harmony together. Goodman Brown cried out, and his cry was lost to his own ear, by its unison with the cry of the desert. In the interval of silence he stole forward until the light glared full upon his eyes. At one extremity of an open space, hemmed in by the dark wall of the forest, arose a rock, bearing some rude natural resemblance, either to an altar or a pulpit, and surrounded by four blazing pines, their tops aflame, their stems untouched, like candles at an evening meeting. The mass of foliage that had overgrown the summit of the rock was all on fire, blazing high into the night and fitfully illuminating the whole field. Each pendant twig and leafy festoon was in a blaze. As the red light arose and fell, a numerous congregation alternately shone forth, then disappeared in shadow, and again grew, as it were, out of the darkness, peopling the heart of the solitary woods at once. "A grave and dark-clad company," quoth Goodman Brown. In truth, they were such. Among them, quivering to and fro between gloom and splendour, appeared faces that would be seen next day at the council board of the province, and others which, Sabbath after Sabbath, looked devoutly heavenward and benignantly over the crowded pews from the holiest pulpits in the land. Some affirm that the lady of the governor was there. At least there were high dames well known to her, and wives of honoured husbands, and widows a great multitude, and ancient maidens all of excellent repute, and fair young girls who trembled lest their mothers should espy them. Either the sudden gleams of light flashing over the obscure field bedazzled Goodman Brown, or he recognized a score of the church members of Salem Village, famous for their especial sanctity. Good old Deacon Gookin had arrived, and waiting at the skirts of that venerable saint, his reverend pastor. But irreverently consorting with these grave, reputable, and pious people, these elders of the church, these chaste dames and dewy virgins, there were men of dissolute lives and women of spotted fame, wretches given to all mean and filthy vice and suspected even of horrid crimes. It was strange to see that the good shrank not from the wicked, nor were the sinners abashed by the saints. Scattered also among their pale-faced enemies were the Indian priests, or powwows, who had often scared their native forest with more hideous incantations than any known to English witchcraft. "But where is faith?" thought Goodman Brown, and as hope came into his heart, he trembled. Another verse of the hymn arose, a slow and mournful strain such as the pious love, but joined to words which expressed all that our nature can conceive of sin and darkly hinted at far more. Unfathomable to mere mortals is the lore of fiends. Verse after verse was sung, and still the chorus of the desert swelled between like the deepest tone of a mighty organ. And with the final peal of that dreadful anthem there came a sound, as if the roaring wind, the rushing streams, the howling beasts, and every other voice of the unconverted wilderness were mingling and according with the voice of guilty man, in homage to the prince of all. The four blazing pines threw up a loftier flame, and obscurely discovered shapes and visages of horror on the smoke wreaths above the impious assembly. At the same moment, the fire on the rock shot redly forth and formed a glowing arch above its base, where now appeared a figure. With reverence be it spoken, the figure bore no slight similitude, both in garb and manner, to some grave divine of the New England churches. "Bring forth the converts," cried a voice that echoed through the field and rolled into the forest. At the word, Goodman Brown stepped forth from the shadow of the trees, and approached the congregation, with whom he felt a loathful brotherhood, by the sympathy of all that was wicked in his heart. He could have well nigh sworn that the shape of his own dead father beckoned him to advance, looking downward from a smoke wreath, while a woman, with dim features of despair, threw out her hand to warn him back. Was it his mother? But he had no power to retreat one step, nor to resist, even in thought, when the minister and good old Deacon Gookin seized his arms and led him to the blazing rock. Thither came also the slender form of a veiled female, led between Goody Cloyes, that pious teacher of the catechism, and Martha Carrier, who had received the devil's promise to be queen of hell. A rampant hag was she, and there stood the proselytes beneath the canopy of fire. "Welcome, my children," said the dark figure, "to the communion of your race. Ye have found thus young your nature and your destiny. My children, look behind you." They turned, and flashing forth, as it were, in a sheet of flame, the fiend worshippers were seen, The smile of welcome gleamed darkly on every visage. "There," resumed the sable form, "are all whom ye have reverenced from youth. Ye deemed them holier than yourselves, and shrank from your own sin, contrasting it with their lives of righteousness and prayerful aspirations heavenward. Yet here are they all, in my worshipping assembly. This night it shall be granted you to know their secret deeds, how hoary elders of the church have whispered wanton words to the young maids of their households, how many a woman eager for widow's weeds has given her husband a drink at bedtime and let him sleep his last sleep in her bosom, how beardless youth have made haste to inherit their father's wealth, and how fair damsels, blush not, sweet ones, have dug little graves in the garden and bidden me, the sole guest, to an infant's funeral. By the sympathy of your human hearts for sin, ye shall scent out all the places, whether in church, bedchamber, street, field, or forest, where crime has been committed, and shall exult to behold the whole earth one stain of guilt, one mighty blood spot. Far more than this, it shall be yours to penetrate in every bosom the deep mystery of sin, the fountain of all wicked arts, and which inexhaustibly supplies more evil impulses than human power, than my power at its utmost, can make manifest in deeds. And now, my children, look upon each other." They did so, and by the blaze of the hell-kindled torches the wretched man beheld his faith, and the wife, her husband, trembling before that unhallowed altar. "Lo, there ye stand, my children," said the figure, in a deep and solemn tone, almost sad with its despairing awfulness, as if his once angelic nature could yet mourn for our miserable race. "Depending on one another's hearts, ye had still hoped that virtue were not all a dream. Now are ye undeceived. Evil is the nature of mankind. Evil must be your only happiness. Welcome again, my children, to the communion of your race." "Welcome!" repeated the fiend worshippers in one cry of despair and triumph. And there they stood, the only pair, as it seemed, who were yet hesitating on the verge of wickedness in this dark world. A basin was hollowed, naturally, in the rock. Did it contain water, reddened by the lurid light? Or was it blood, or perchance a liquid flame? Herein did the shape of evil dip his hand, and prepare to lay the mark of baptism upon their foreheads, that they might be partakers of the mystery of sin, more conscious of the secret guilt of others, both in deed and thought, than they could now be of their own. The husband cast one look at his pale wife, and faith at him. What polluted wretches would the next glance show them to each other, shuddering alike at what they disclosed and what they saw? "Faith, faith," cried the husband, "look up to heaven and resist the wicked one." Whether faith obeyed, he knew not. Hardly had he spoken when he found himself amid calm night and solitude, listening to a roar of the wind which died heavily away through the forest. He staggered against the rock and felt it chill and damp, while a hanging twig that had been all on fire besprinkled his cheek with the coldest dew. The next morning, young Goodman Brown came slowly into the street of Salem Village, staring around him like a bewildered man. The good old minister was taking a walk along the graveyard to get an appetite for breakfast and meditate his sermon, and bestowed a blessing as he passed on Goodman Brown. He shrank from the venerable saint as if to avoid an anathema. Old Deacon Gookin was at domestic worship, and the holy words of his prayer were heard through the open window. "What god doth the wizard pray to?" quoth Goodman Brown. Goody Cloyes, that excellent old Christian, stood in the early sunshine at her own lattice, catechizing a little girl who had brought her a pint of morning's milk. Goodman Brown snatched away the child as from the grasp of the fiend himself. Turning the corner by the meeting house, he spied the head of Faith, with the pink ribbons, gazing anxiously forth, and bursting into such joy at the sight of him that she skipped along the street and almost kissed her husband before the whole village. But Goodman Brown looked sternly and sadly into her face and passed on without a greeting. Had Goodman Brown fallen asleep in the forest and only dreamed a wild dream of a witch meeting? Be it so, if you will. But alas, it was a dream of evil omen for young Goodman Brown. A stern, a sad, a darkly meditative, A distrustful, if not a desperate man did he become, from the night of that fearful dream. On the Sabbath day, when the congregation were singing a holy psalm, he could not listen, because an anthem of sin rushed loudly upon his ear and drowned all the blessed strain. When the minister spoke from the pulpit with power and fervid eloquence, and with his hand on the open Bible of the sacred truths of our religion, and of saint-like lives and triumphant deaths, and of future bliss or misery unutterable, then did Goodman Brown turn pale, dreading lest the roof should thunder down upon the grey blasphemer and his hearers. Often awakening suddenly at midnight, he shrank from the bosom of faith, and at morning or eventide, when the family knelt down at prayer, he scowled and muttered to himself and gazed sternly at his wife and turned away. And when he had lived long and was borne to his grave, a hoary corpse, followed by Faith, an aged woman, and children and grandchildren, a goodly procession, besides neighbours, not a few, they carved no hopeful verse upon his tombstone, for his dying hour was gloom.
And that was Young Goodman Brown by Nathaniel Hawthorne, and I'm joined by Neil Poole to discuss the story as ever. Pooley, episode 2, and there's a delightful link between it and episode 1. This story by Hawthorne is the inspiration for the man in the black suit, which formed our discussion point in episode 1 of this season. It's a very powerful wee story. I've found it immensely engaging on so many levels. There's the great historical stuff that you can get stuck into, which I was familiar with and massively interested in anyway, but to go into in a bit more detail was great. Then to find out some details about Hawthorne himself, which I didn't know. I'd read The Scarlet Letter in college like everybody else, but apart from that I had very little Hawthorne knowledge. And to find out how he's so intimately connected with Salem and the witch trials and things like that was a lovely revelation. One question, Neil, that's going to be hanging around everybody's head, and we might as well get it dealt with from the start, and that is the question of the way in which this story sort of pans out. We all detest that it was only a dream type stories and endings. To me, this is so much more than that, but we do need to address, because it will be in everyone's mind, do you think what happened in the forest happened? And in fact, do you think what happened in the forest, does it matter when you when you take into account the impact that it has on Goodman Brown and his life from there on in?
Ooh, two questions. Okay, right. So I think all of the indications are in the text is that it is a dream. So a close reading of the text indicates and points to the fact that he has in fact dreamt this night at Black Mass or Communion with the devil. There's a few reasons for that that are in the text, things that indicated. So obviously the very fact that the whole scene just dissipates around him suggests that it's a dream. The fact that the burning pines, when he comes around and he's lying in the forest and it says that the pine needles that were actually burning, it talks about them being moist with dew, which would suggest that they were not on fire at all. And little things like when he's in the forest, you know, he sees the pink ribbons of Faith, his wife, falling from, you know, the sky. But then at the end, when he sees Faith again, you know, they're back in her hair, so suggesting that those ribbons weren't real. And there's other things as well. I mean, the whole story is quite a fantastical story. The idea of meeting like the devil in the woods, and you know, not entirely normal. So you know, they are the types of things that you could dream about. So there is a suggestion, a quite strong suggestion, that it is a dream. Does it matter? Well, that's obviously a different question, and I think that's where it gets a little bit more interesting. My answer to that is no, it doesn't matter. I think right at the start of the story, it actually sets up the idea that dreams are powerful and that dreams can take hold of someone's mind as such, because when Goodman Brown is actually leaving at the start, he's leaving Faith at the beginning, there's actually a couple of references to the dreams that she's had, and it's the dreams that she's had which forewarn danger, and give a sense that something bad is about to happen, and that when you dream something, it's not just simply in your head, that it has a wider impact, you know, or it could have a wider influence on your future, you know, whether it be telling the future or whether there's just a sort of wider power there. So I think what's important is the Puritan religious nature of this is important, in the sense that obviously Goodman Brown's a Puritan, so it's a very, very hardcore religious ideology as such, where morality is really important. And I think what's very important with this is that simply by dreaming this stuff, in Goodman Brown's mind, that makes him a sinner. The very fact that his own brain, his own morality could conjure up these actual thoughts makes him a sinner. So does it matter whether it's a dream or not? No, not really, because it still has the same impact on his life, which, as we see, he's miserable for the rest of his life and he dies in gloom. And also, whether it happens or not, you've got to take it in the religious and historical context of the time, in which the belief is that simply by these thoughts being in your mind, whether you put them there subconsciously or consciously, that makes you a sinner. So the impact is still the same. But for my own enjoyment of the story, I'd like to think it's just not a dream. Because so if you take away the elements that it is a dream, then it's just a better story, I think.
I find myself flip-flopping a bit and then pretty much always landing on the side of it's not a dream at all, and all the sort of evidential things you were talking about earlier on, well, that's perfectly normal when you're dealing with the world of the occult. And as Verbal Kint said, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. And if you're sitting there looking like Verbal Kint when you're actually a cold-blooded killer like Kaiser Soze, you know, there's added heft to that particular judgment on things. I think the most important thing you've touched on there is the concept of what the story is really about. And when we start thinking about what the story is really about, I mean, there's all sorts of themes here. It's the reality of sin, and therefore the religious paradigm it exists in, and the extreme religious paradigm in which sin becomes such a real thing. We can see the pervasiveness of evil in this story. It's pretty unrelenting and it's pretty unforgiving, and everyone who appears to be good is actually wretched, and that sort of inversion is right at the heart of Satanism, as I can understand it from what I've read. Something else we see there is the hypocrisy of everybody, but in particular, Foley, and you went here, the hypocrisy of Puritanism. And we can see as another theme the really demoralizing effects that the discovery of man's inherent weakness and frailty and capacity for sin has on the central character, because that is what leaves him a broken man. That's what leaves him distrustful, bitter, fearful, anxious, incapable of making the kind of bonds he should be making, of enjoying the life that he left on that fateful night when he lost his faith. You know, there's a lot going on, Neil. It's such a brilliant story in that regard. I there's so many angles I don't even know where to start, but we should tee it up a little bit, I think, by giving some of what you talked about there, given that historical and religious context, but specifically starting with the historical context. And I do want to talk about Hawthorne later on himself and his own personal biographical angle on this. But just so that people understand, I mean, yeah, we do have a story here where you've got a classic literary trope, which is a kind of a Faustian pact. And the Puritans were very concerned with this idea of communion with the devil, or some sort of interaction with the devil. Do you have a setup for me a little bit about Puritanism, what it is, what the background is in terms of this story? Because there are lots of little significant, specific details here which root it very much in reality, especially in the interactions between the devil character and Goodman Brown.
Yeah, I think what is important is the reason that there's Puritans in this part of the world. So it's like, you know, New England, northeast coast of America. So obviously, Puritans are originally from England, and they leave England famously on the Mayflower in the the early 17th century. And the reason that they leave England is to move to the New World so that they can be closer to God, and that they can worship God and be closer to God in a way that is a lot more extreme. That wouldn't be the way they see it, but for the ones of me explaining it, more extreme than what's going on in England at the time. And what's really important, and is important in terms of this story, is that with Puritanism, there's a real sense of the collective morality, and it's where it's the morality of them as a group of people, as Puritans as a whole, that helps them to define themselves and define their relationship with God. So therefore, that's really important in this story, because what Goodman Brown sees as he goes along the way is person after person after person in this community being immoral or amoral, and going to this black mass in the middle of the forest. So it's important to bear that in mind, that when he's seeing these people, every single one of these is like, you know, a dagger in the heart of his belief, and is another sort of chunk taken out of his faith as well. Also, what you've got as well is the whole idea that this is set in the forest, and there's a real fear of the natural world in Puritanism. And so what happens is, when they move over to the New World, there's this need to dominate it. And it's a little bit like, you know, I think you still have it in Japan now. There's like forests, you know, there's thought to be like, you know, sort of spirits in there and everything, and people are very suspicious about forests. Well, that's exactly the same back then in the 17th century. There's a real, real superstition and fear of the forest. And just the very fact that he sees people from his village having a stroll through the forest, it's like that in and of itself is sinful. So forget the fact where they're going, you know, to this, it's like a worship the devil and what have you, but it's even just those little things where just seeing those people having a stroll through the forest, that in itself is alarming to Goodman Brown. So that gives you a little bit of the setup. There's other things as well about what the devil says soon, but I'm sure you'll probably come to that, or I can cover it if you want.
Yeah, you've teed me up beautifully. And just in case anyone's looking for sort of a visceral visual example of what this era looks like, what the people looked like, the type of life that was lived, you could look at The Crucible, the Arthur Miller play. There's a fantastic film version of it starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Or you could look at Robert Eggers' film The Witch, which came out in 2015, and that is a remarkable piece of work. And that leans heavily into the occult and witchcraft. We have exactly what you spoke about there, the massive uneasiness of the people in the environment, the fact that they don't seem to fit, that their religion that they're trying to impose is constantly being pushed back against. In the film The Witch, the kids are sort of not quite possessed, but very much begin to be enthralled to a boar, a pig called Black Philip. And it's remarkable stuff. It really is. And very affecting. But just again, for the look of stuff. But
I was just going to say, there's also the film, have you seen The Village? I think it was it's directed by the fella who does Sixth Sense and Unbreakable.
M. Night Shyamalan, yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Massive, yeah.
And it knows what, I mean, the whole premise, I mean there is a twist at the end of that, and I won't spoil it, but the whole premise of that film is that, you know, you don't go into the woods. There's a barrier around the village, and there's a monster in the woods, and if you go into the woods, that monster will kill you. So that idea is, you know, that's there in the films as well. Like all of those films I just mentioned, the woods are always there on the periphery, where they, you know, they very rarely venture in. And if they do venture in, whatever movie it may be, it's a part of heightened tension.
You know, and it is really interesting, because quite often I come from a very strict Catholic background, upbringing. That's what my parents were, remain. I lapsed into some sort of nothingness a long time ago, and my own personal sort of journey towards having some sort of interest in spirituality has been very complicated and interesting, and I find myself interested in the whole concept of consciousness all the time. But here we do have this really classic example of what, you know, look, despite what people might want to think, very much exists, and it exists in some of the more powerful echelons of society, which is this kind of what can be simplified as satanic belief system, and in that inversion, like I said, is very, very important. But what helps root this story, Neil, is the fact that the little specific details that are dropped in there, for example, we can place this story very easily because Hawthorne mentions that it takes place in the days of King William. That's William III. He reigned from 1688 to 1702. Other evidence is the reference to the Quakers. And again, the Quakers were a group of people who were persecuted, including by Brown's grandfather in the 1660s. And then there's a mention of King Philip's War, which was basically a massacre of Indians by colonists in 1675 or 1676. And again, Brown's father participated in that. There is a guilt in Nathaniel Hawthorne about his puritanical past, his family's puritanical past, which absolutely haunts this story. And it's very, very interesting. I mean, there are so many things I want to talk about, but we have a limited time because it's a long story and people have already been listening for a while. So I want us to talk about the favorite things that we really found interesting. We've tried to tee it up there, and I will talk about Nathaniel Hawthorne's background a little bit whenever it seems apposite before the end. But let's get into some of the good bits about the story. I mean, if I was to say, what specific area would you love to focus on next? What would you go with?
My favorite part of it is the many different ways in which the story unpicks the idea that, you know, that evil or the devil, or let's call it evil, lies within Goodman Brown and lies within all men and women, and it's something you can't escape. So it starts with what we've seen in terms of, you know, is his kinship, you know, his town folk, and you sort of see them going. It's all of the things that you've just said there in terms of where you see it's in his hereditary DNA, you know, his dad and his granddad are not anywhere near as pure as we were thinking. You know, the sinners, they've been involved in genocide. I mean, I'm really bringing my own reflection to this, but the whole thing, it particularly interests me that it's the Quakers that they persecute, because in my line of work, I've come in contact with different religious groups, and Quakers are one of them. And the Quakers are probably the most inoffensive, chilled back religious people you could probably ever meet. You know what I mean? They're really, really inoffensive. So the idea in this that it's Quakers who are persecuted, to me, is, it really accentuates the idea about how extremely Puritans are in this as well. So there's that whole side of it, you know, where it's in his, as I said, it's in his DNA, it's in his family. Then it's just like little touches, little things where, you know, when he meets the devil looks a lot like him. You know, he just looks like an older version of him, and they're wearing similar clothes and a sort of similar class. And it immediately introduces this idea that, you know, you're not that different to the person that, or the creature or the entity that you despise. And it goes through the story. And then I know we've just discussed previously that I think independently we came up with our own sort of favorite part of the story. And this is my final bit on this, sort of just this depiction of where, you know, the monster or the evil can come out of all people. So this is the bit where he's in the forest, you know, he's starting to go a little bit mad, shall we say. And it just says, on he flew among the black pines, brandishing his staff with frenzied gestures, now giving vent to an inspiration of horrid blasphemy, and now shouting forth such laughter as set all of the echoes of the forest laughing like demons around him. Then this is my favourite bit, Trev. The fiend in his own shape is less hideous than when he rages in the breast of man. And I think that's really, really good in terms of, there's nothing more scary, there's nothing more alarming, there's nothing more horrific than when you see evil in human form rather than in some sort of monstrous like aberration. I think it's when you know you watch horror films, it's the reason like horror films that are set in realistic settings and where like, you know, the, you know, maybe things with serial killers or whatever are far more creepy than when it, you know, it's just like some sort of fantastical monster. So I love the way there's loads and loads of different ways through both form and content in which that idea of, you know, evil being innate in you or innate in man and something that you can't escape and always there laying dormant, ready to be brought out, is represented and demonstrated in so many different ways in this story, and is also at the heart of his crisis and the way he lives the rest of his life, where, you know, it's something that he realizes.
That's so good, man, because at the start of the story, the thing I've always found a little bit jarring and wondered about was, why does he feel he must do it? Is it almost like a rite of passage that everyone in the village at a certain time they go and they take part in this communion with the devil, with Satan, whatever, the black mass, the whole thing? Because the way the picture is painted later on, it's quite the festival atmosphere, you know, it genuinely is. And I think there's no two ways about it, but that this concept that you're highlighting here, this idea of the sort of innate capacity for evil, is the central idea in this story. You can't get away from it. And you come back to it right at the end because it's the thing that haunts Goodman Brown all his days. It's the thing that means he goes to his death with no peace. It's the thing that means that he dies a dark and hopeless individual, because he has had this epiphany, this realization of exactly what you said, that there is this inherent capacity in all of us for darkness. And the part that you focused on, yeah, you're right, that is the part that I think was both of our favorite, and it builds so beautifully, because as he cowers in the forest and he's having his crisis of faith, and will he possibly just go back, and yes, I will, and I'll return to faith, and then he keeps, these other characters keep coming, and, you know, he's forced to listen in. And then, of course, there's this whole thing where the entirety of the forest seems to be making some sort of drama for him. And in it, he can hear, and no one ever wants to hear, you know, Conan the Barbarian talked about it. But there's the voice of a young woman uttering lamentations with an uncertain sorrow, entreating for some favor which perhaps it would grieve her to obtain. That's very specific. And when you start thinking about those words, what the hell does that mean? And it means that she is actually, as far as I can understand it, pleading for something which will be her doom, which will curse her. And it's really dark. And as he hears these lamentations and cries, he's saying faith and faith. And he says, you know, my faith is gone. And at that point, this is my favorite part, and it's what you built into there. He just leans into it. The dawning of what life truly is, of what man truly is, his broken spirit, even though like there's still this little bit of fight in them when they're actually at the black mass, don't commit, will I commit, don't commit, faith, you blah, blah, blah. He's gone at this stage. And like you say, this is the turning point, and it's so powerful. As I read this, Neil, I swear to God, my hair was sticking up in the back of my neck every time I read it, because I can visualize this. You know, when you come across a piece of writing, and I mean, all writing has this capacity, but it makes you genuinely visualize. And I've never seen anything, a picture, a film version, anything. I've never seen anything about young Goodman Brown in the past, but I have the most powerful image of him, this demoniac, as he's referred to, sort of powering through the forest in some completely unnatural way, cackling like a lunatic, like the lunatic devil that we came across in The Man in the Black Suit, with that sort of, there's a lovely line in that King story about how there's always this sort of laughter, this enjoyment in reveling in the darkness with this evil figure. And Goodman Brown, as you said, he becomes worse than anything you could imagine. He is the worst kind of fiend. And it's just so important to think about this. I think it's the key section where he says, to hell with you all. He says, let us hear which will laugh loudest. Think not to frighten me with your deviltry. Come witch, come wizard, come Indian powwow, come devil himself, he says. And here comes Goodman Brown. You may as well fear him as he fear you. That's it. That's the moment he twists, he turns. That's the moment his mind breaks. It doesn't really matter what happens after that, because that's the key. As you said, that's him now. He is the demoniac. He's come to think of himself in this way. And I suppose we can lead back out of this into the whole idea of, is this part of Hawthorne's plan to show us the darkness that was inherent in the Puritanism, the horrible, horrible hypocrisy that was at the heart of that, that, you know, there were, like every power structure in history ever, people will rise to positions of supremacy, and they will exploit their human nature, will give way to the weaknesses that all human nature has over the course of time when power is involved. Is that very much part of it for you? Because to me, that's sort of the overriding message that I'm getting from this. And we can lead out of this into a little bit of a chat about Salem and Hawthorne himself and his background.
Yeah, I think it is. And I mean, you've pretty much covered that aspect of it. But so just to sort of to develop on that a little bit in terms of, is that what Hawthorne is trying to say? I think the level of reality and therefore the level of integrity that he imposes on this fictional story says to me that it is a commentary on real life events and things that have occurred, you know, in American history per se. So there are like little touches, just like little things, like, so you mentioned then the Salem witch trials. So in this story, there's two female characters mentioned, Goody Cloyse and Martha Carrier. So they're the fictional names of characters in this story. However, when you look at it, they're two of the actual real women who were killed during the Salem witch trials. And all of the stuff that you mentioned earlier about, you know, King Philip's War and all of this sort of stuff, there's so many little droplets of real bits of fact within a fictional story that says to me that everything that you just said is asking the question, you know, is Hawthorne commenting on, you know, power and power historically and the way it's abused and Puritans historically, then it leads me to think that yes, it is, because why would you put these like little actual bits of reality and then bits of integrity in a fictional story otherwise? So to answer your question, yes, I think very much he is doing that.
I'm going to come back to you for whatever your takeaway point is at the end, but just for the benefit of people who are, yeah, I've heard of this idea of witches and Salem. Just a couple of little salient points I wanted to fill in. The Salem witch trials themselves were a series of hearings, prosecutions. As Neil has told you, people were accused of witchcraft. It took place in colonial Massachusetts between 1692 and 1693. There were 200 people in all accused, which, you know, when you think about the significance of the event and the amount of people, it's strange. It has a very powerful cultural resonance. 30 of those people were found guilty, 19 of whom were executed by hanging. There were 14 women and 5 men in that group. Another man, the unfortunate Giles Corey, was pressed to death, which sounds particularly horrific, for refusing to plead. And then 5 people died whilst waiting in jail, probably as a result of terrible, terrible treatment.
Trev,
the witch trials,
do we know what being pressed to death entails?
Quite literally crushed.
All right.
Now, how it was done, I just didn't upset myself with the details of it. But yeah, that's...
I'll look into that.
It is, of course, thought of as one of the most notorious cases of mass hysteria. And I want to mention this because there are lots of brilliant theories. I've read lots and lots of cool theories, something about perhaps some sort of agent, chemical agent, reactive agent in the bread, in the mold in the bread, which perhaps created this mass hysteria. That to me has always seemed a little bit... little bit CIA retrofitting
well,
nonsense.
Well, Trev, well, you know what? You know, if you do look back through history, though, there is, because they reckon the fall of the Roman Empire was because of lead in the water, don't they? You know, in the viaducts and everything, and it led to like bad decision making on the part of. No, but I've seen a documentary about it. It must be real. So all I'm saying is don't belittle the chemical, you know, the chemical effects. That's all I'm saying.
Neil, I genuinely love the idea, but the idea that it went on ad nauseum, and what it completely ignores is the witch finder generals that were living in and operating across in Europe. There was a whole culture around that, and the fact that it lasted so long, I don't know. I have my doubts about some of the stories here, but I do want to just let people know as well that this story sort of is kind of set around about the time of those witch trials. And Hawthorne's great granddaddy, John Hawthorne, spelt without a W, was a judge. And apparently most of the received wisdom from biographies and from various things I've read is that Hawthorne did have an amount of guilt over his family history and his great granddaddy in particular. In fact, he changed the spelling and added a W to the family name after he graduated from college. And I think you can see there's a questioning of an awful lot of the more traditional religious established thought in his writing, in Young Goodman Brown, in a lot of his big novels like The Scarlet Letter. There is this look at the occult. There is this look at a very askance look at Puritanism and the hypocrisy that he believed to be inherent in it. And it's just massively interesting to me. There's so many angles that you could spend half an hour talking about, but I do want to give you one chance at the end of the show to talk about something that specifically you wanted to get off your chest from the notes that you've made.
I've got two possible ways I can go with this. I can either go with something based on booze, or something on literature, or something on both. You choose, Trev. Go on, let's have multiple choice.
I actually want both. Start with the literature, and we'll finish out with the more lighthearted booze angle.
Yeah. So my literature point is a wider one, and it's one of the reasons that I like this story so much, because while it is full of tropes, I like the way in which it's different to a lot of like classic literature. So you mentioned earlier the Faustian pack thing and what have you. Now, I think the way in which it differs to the Faustian pact is really interesting. I'm glad that Hawthorne's done something a little bit different with it. So obviously, Faustian pack, if you go back to Christopher Marlowe's play, Dr. Faustus, or I say Christopher Marlowe's play if he wrote it. I think he wrote about half of it, but there's definitely parts of it where you can tell it's being written by someone else. But anyway, I digress. So what's really interesting about Dr. Faustus, the play from like the 1550s or 1560s, I think, is that Faustus sells his soul, and what he sells his soul for is 24 years of power. And then what happens in that story is essentially, it's different to this. What he does is he fritters away that power. So he has 24 years where he can have access to all of the knowledge and learnings in the world, because it's a Renaissance play, and that's part of the theme when everyone's discovering new things in the world. And he fritters it all away. But you can see why he makes that pact. I'll sell my soul for 24 years of good times as such. What I think is really interesting in this is when you get to the bit at the end where they're having the, you know, the communion with the devil, and it talks about what they get out of it. Well, what you get out of it is knowing all of the bad things in the world, like knowing all of the terrible, horrendous secrets that people have. And I just think that's where it's really interesting. And in a way, it's probably quite a... Well, I say it's a modern story, but maybe it's just a more honest, universal story about the interest that humans have in the macabre. I mean, in the days in which we live now, then obviously the things that people like click on, you know, are things that can be quite shocking or quite horrendous. And the news that you watch that captures people's imagination and sort of they're more interested in is terrible things, essentially. So I've just always been interested with that aspect of the story, that this pact isn't a pact in which, you know, you give up your soul and you get something good in your return, but it's all bad. yet he walks into that decision and wants to seemingly make that decision, as does the rest of the town. Now, I've got no conclusion about that, but I just think it's an interesting slant on this story that's quite different to a lot of other literature that you would expect to read.
I've got to come in here because you are saying that it's all bad, and yet if you think about, like I said, what I described as the almost festival-like atmosphere, if you think about the conversations between the clergymen on their way, the conversation was it Goody Cloyes on route.
Yeah.
They're all excited about what's coming. Oh, there's a young woman to be taken into the communion. There's a young man. Oh, and they're all excited. And the atmosphere is heady. And they are clearly willing to sacrifice.
But they're excited because they're about to see two people corrupted. So, you know, so you can still be excited and everything. You still think something's good. But what I'm saying, it's like the ultimate Schadenfreude, isn't it? It's like they're gleeful and excited about at the prospect of seeing something terrible happening. Now, they might be doing it in a festival, carnival type atmosphere, but I still think it gets down to that sort of deep rooted. This is a story, isn't it, about, you know, innate and dormant darkness in people. And I think this is just another way in which it reflects it. I'm not saying you're wrong, Trev. You know, they're having a laugh and all of that.
No,
but I think it's quite interesting what they're excited about seeing.
I think you're right. And I think you're right to push it back to the concept of what the story is really about, which I think, like something like 1984, this relentlessly inevitable capacity that all humankind has for evil. That's it. It's just dark. It's just sort of, it's almost crushingly inevitable. And maybe that's exactly what you're saying, is that there's no massive trade-off for these people. It's not like Robert Johnson gets to be the best blues musician ever and be the father of modern music by selling his soul at the crossroads. It's not that. It's just a draw, an attraction, a hopeless attraction to that darker side of humanity, stroke, whatever the hell that is that they're engaging with, not to put too many labels on it. And I know that you do have something slightly less literary to finish us off with.
Well, you say that, I'm still interpreting language on a can here, as I'm about to explain. All right, so I'm drinking booze at the moment, which is unlike me, as you know, Trev. I don't swear on these podcasts and I don't drink on the job. However, I'm a bit thirsty. But I'm drinking a very, very specific bit of booze. So firstly, it's the what do you call them? The brewery, yeah. I've literally had one can, by the way. The brewery, okay, is Irish. Is there anyone between the two of us who were Irish?
That'd be me.
Yeah, go back two generations. I'm with you there, Trev. We're together in the motherland, okay? So, firstly, it's Irish, and we've got a bit of Irish stuff going on here. Second, the actual drink itself is called Atlantean. Atlantean, that must be based on Atlantic. What did the Puritans do? What sea, what ocean did they cross, Trev?
Oh, I love this. Oh, I love it. Yes. I love it. The Atlantic.
Yes. The Atlantic, okay. Do you know what the type of booze I'm drinking is, Trev?
I fancy you as an IPA type of man.
It's a New England IPA. Where's the story, Seth? Yes, okay, right. And then the final one. Do you know what the brewing company is called? And I am not making this up. It's called the White Hag.
Go
which,
on.
Bang, I win. Come on.
Wow.
There you go. We can call it a day. We're never going to beat that, Trev.
No, we need to moonwalk backwards out of this now and just take our curtain call, because that's remarkable. Neil Poole there bringing the synchronicities. The synchronicities. And in a show which is heavily, heavily dominated by chat about the occult, I think that's absolutely fitting. So, as ever, that was a belter. We're going to be back with you very soon. We have another fantastic story for you in episode 3. Looking forward to that massively. In the meantime, We have very exciting news with regard to a website which is being put together by my pal Nebenid Hamu out in Aussie land, and he's doing a super job on that for us. He's a star who took it on, and we appreciate that immensely. When it's all set and up and running, I'll be letting people know all about it on the socials. There's going to be an Instagram account as well, just for the crack. And Pooley has told me that he will do the Facebook nonsense just to get the word out there as well. So we're looking at a new push. And I wanted to have all the ducks in a row before we started releasing episodes. But, you know, like I said last week, to hell with that. The stories are going to come thick and fast. You've had Stephen King. You've had now Nathaniel Hawthorne. And there will be another belter on the way for you very, very soon. So all that is remaining for me to do is to say, as ever, thanks, Neil.